The Red Sox have fired manager John Farrell. What's next for the team and who's next in the manager's role? And where will Farrell land in baseball? It's Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. I'm Chris Gasper, and this is Season Ticket. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Well, the big news today is that John Farrell is out as the manager of the Boston Red Sox after five seasons, a World Series championship, and back-to-back American League East titles the last 2 years, but also back-to-back first-round exits in the playoffs, including this year when the Red Sox were eliminated by the Houston Astros in four games. Joining me now is Joe Sullivan, Boston Globe sports editor. This is big news, obviously, Joe. You know, a lot of people's antenna sort of went up when you didn't have the press conference the day after the season ended that you normally have with Red Sox president of baseball operations, Dave Dombrowski, and the manager, John Farrell. At that point, you knew that Farrell was in trouble. Are you surprised that he's no longer the manager?
I'm not surprised. And you're absolutely right. When last year they had a press conference with Farrell and Dombrowski the same day that the players cleaned out their locker room.
Oh, it was automatic.
Yeah, and it wasn't this year. So right away you knew something was going on. And then Pete Abraham and our other reporters had sources saying that discussions were ongoing about Farrell's future. And once you get to that point, it's not going to end with keeping him, I don't think. It always ends with him leaving or being fired. And so, obviously, Dombrowski, that's what he was doing yesterday. He just told us in this really long press conference. He certainly was willing to give the media his time.
If not his reasons for why he got rid of him.
Yeah, he forgot that he didn't give us those.
Very vague.
I think in those situations, I'm not going to share facts. I mean, those are things that I keep to myself, talk to our baseball officials about. But again, you weigh a bunch of different things. Basically, everything is what you weigh in making a decision like this.
So, yeah, I mean, so we're going to be left to speculate the exact reasons that he let him go because he wasn't going to get into specifics. He got into quite a few other specifics. I hope John Farrell got to have breakfast before he came in and got fired. We found out he called him at 8:30 and Farrell came to Fenway at 9 o'clock and then he let him know. And not surprisingly, Farrell handled it very professionally, according to Dave Dombrowski.
It's not like he was pleased. I would say he was disappointed. But I can't really tell you exactly. It wasn't like he was happy. He was professional with me. You know, I like John Farrell.
But, Chris, you have theories on this. I know you do, about what the real reasons were.
Well, I think it was interesting. It was very clear that Dave Dombrowski was deliberating whether he wanted to move on from John Farrell or not. And he obviously made that decision. And as close as he came to giving a reason for it was simply saying there was time for a change.
Hmm. I guess so. Sometimes people stay too long in these types of jobs. There often are time limits. I think we could compare it to Claude Julien with the Bruins, that his time has probably run out last year. Similar thing, I guess.
You know? Yeah, you could say that. I mean, the other thing I thought Dave Dombrowski said that was interesting was he talked about how he came to the decision and was saying it wasn't a snap decision. In other words, it wasn't based on them being eliminated in the playoffs 2 years in a row. And they got swept by the Cleveland Indians last season, 2016. They lost in four this season, so they lost 6 of 7 playoff games. They won 93 games in back-to-back seasons. I think by a lot of measures, that's success. But the ultimate success, as Dombrowski said, is winning the World Series. And I think that when you look at it, I don't think that Dombrowski felt like Farrell was the guy to get the most out of this roster. And I wrote this in the Globe today, that it's possible that John Farrell does not deserve to be fired based on merit as someone who in his five seasons here won a World Series and 3 American League East titles and won back-to-back AL East titles. But at the same time, he's not the guy who got the most out of this roster. And ultimately, I feel like that's why Dombrowski made this decision. I think he feels like there's somebody else who can get more out of this roster and create a better environment in the clubhouse that is more conducive to this team reaching its full potential. Because even though they won 93 games, it's not like you had guys that had great seasons. They were inconsistent in terms of hitting and scoring runs. You had the whole situation with David Price and Dennis Eckersley, which I think soured a lot of fans on the team, which is never good. So when you look at it overall, yes, the wins and losses during the regular season were good, but there were some other things during the season that were unsightly and certainly not the way you'd want them to be if you're Dombrowski.
Well said, Chris, and well written in today's paper. I have to compliment you. And look, here's what it comes down to, I believe. This is not Minnesota. So winning divisions and getting eliminated in the first round of playoffs just isn't good enough. This the goal every year for every team in Boston is to win a championship. And so there's a certain leeway you can give a manager or a coach in that situation. But time runs out, and this looks like it was going the other way. That championship got further and further in the mirror.
Yeah, I think that's how Dombrowski...
The rear view mirror, I should say.
That's how Dombrowski fell. And there were some other things I thought he said that were interesting. He did specifically mention the role of the manager dealing with the media. The idea you have to put out sort of these media brush fires. He didn't say that, but that's what he alluded to. Media brush fires in Boston, which is different from some other places. And I don't think John Farrell was great at that.
So you're talking about, are you referring specifically to the Eckersley, Price?
I think that certainly was one of them, but I think there have been other ones in the past.
People who don't know that one, we should tell them that Price berated Eckersley on a plane.
Yeah, the Red Sox, big time ace, David Price, on the team charter, decided to upbraid announcer Dennis Eckersley, who's a former player in the Hall of Fame. But yeah, I mean, you don't see, that was something where nobody in uniform ever apologized to Hall of Famer Dennis Eckersley for humiliating him and embarrassing him on the team charter. And I think that was something that, again, bothered a lot of fans and maybe spoke to the clubhouse culture and the fact that Farrell was not the guy to bring guys back in line. And something else Dombrowski said was that sometimes when a manager's with a team for a while, the message can get stale. It can start to fall on deaf ears. That, again, was something that caught my ear from Dombrowski in terms of one of the reasons maybe why he got rid of Farrell. Because, again, he was extremely vague. I mean, he said many times he was not going to get into the specifics of why he made this decision. But I do think he left some breadcrumbs for us, Joe.
Yeah. Farrell, as you say, not one to come down hard in the clubhouse. And that may be part of baseball culture in general. But you're right. He didn't get people in line when he had to. Yes.
Which is ironic because when he first came here, I remember former Red Sox pitcher Clay Buchholz saying that he was afraid of him. And Farrell sort of had this John Wayne-esque stature when he was here before as Terry Francona's pitching coach. But obviously over the 5 years he was here as manager, that significantly changed. And I think that's one of the reasons he's no longer in the job. All right. Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
Let's do it again.
Next up, to continue this discussion about Farrell and the future of the Red Sox, now joining us via Skype is MLB Network and Fox Sports reporter John Paul Morosi. John Paul, what's up? How are you?
Outstanding, Chris. My friend, it's been about 15 years since we met on the Hawk desk at the Boston Globe, so an honor to be with you today.
Yeah, always an honor, man. I'll tell a quick story. So John Paul and I go back a ways. We were both editorial assistants, basically gophers here at the Boston Globe Sports Department. Obviously, John Paul made better choices than I did, because if you were watching the Red Sox playoff series against the Houston Astros, you saw John Paul on TV interviewing the players. So you've certainly done very well for yourself, John Paul.
Well, and Chris, likewise, my friend, you got a column in the Globe. That is a much higher level of achievement than giving weather updates on a front moving through Fenway Park in the course of a game. But I appreciate the sentiments.
Only one of us has a Harvard education. I think you guys can guess it's not me. John Paul, let's get down to business here. The Red Sox had a tough decision to make with John Farrell. JP, what do you think was the deciding factor in Dombrowski firing Farrell?
Well, Chris, there's a lot of issues here, and I do think that Dave has made difficult decisions before. He fired a very popular figure in Tigers history in Alan Trammell back after the 2005 season. But at that point in time, he knew that he had Jim Leland waiting in the wings, and someone that he knew well, someone he won a World Series championship with the Marlins in 97. I don't know, Chris, who that analog would be right now, who that next great option is. What we know well, Torrey Lovullo is in Arizona. He is not coming to Boston right now. So the longtime heir apparent is not available. In time, I think that the scrutiny will find its way to Dave for the next hire. And if that new managerial hire does not go well, I think then all of a sudden he has sort of already burned that one card that many GMs have, which is to let go of the manager who was in place at the time they took over.
You cover baseball nationally. I know that locally, regionally, there certainly was a lot of criticism of John Farrell and the job that he did as Red Sox manager. But despite that, he did lead the team to 3 American League East championships, a World Series championship, and back-to-back American League East championships the last 2 seasons. So around baseball, how is John Farrell perceived?
Chris, John Farrell is very highly regarded in the game. Now, there's not that many jobs out there, but his level of regard is high because he's got a very good background of certainly understanding pitching, as we know, by profession and winning the World Series with the Red Sox as a pitching coach before he won it as a manager. But he also understands player development, which he did for a long time in Cleveland. And the Cleveland Indians player development stamp is a strong one. You look around the game and those that are either GMs or involved in, on field staffs in a very prominent level, whether it's Mike Hazen in Arizona, Neil Huntington, who was more of a scout with Cleveland. But there is a very strong Cleveland tree, if you will, and John Farrell's part of that. And there's an understanding, Chris, that I believe in many respects, and I may or may not be alone in this opinion around the game, that the Red Sox managerial job is probably the hardest one in the game, based on the scrutiny, based on the pressure of the fans, and I mean that in a good way. The expectations are very high, and I think even in a city like New York, there are so many different things going on there, all the different pro teams there, even with the Yankees, and yes, there's pressure on Joe Girardi right now, as we're seeing. The scrutiny on the manager of the Red Sox is acute, is unique, and there's a reason why. You look at the history of the franchise, Chris. Since Joe Cronin, only one man has managed the Red Sox for more than five consecutive seasons in a row, and that person is Terry Francona. And this year for John Farrell was his fifth full season.
Yeah, certainly not a lot of job security with the Red Sox managerial job. JP, I don't think either of us are under the assumption that firing John Farrell will magically fix all of the Red Sox problems, particularly in the postseason. I think you have to look at the roster, too, and guys who did not perform or underperformed the last two postseasons. You know that Dave Dombrowski likes stars. Do you see him bringing in someone like Giancarlo Stanton? Because I wrote in the Globe today, John Paul, that I think they need to look at not just minor modifications, but some sort of significant upgrade to this lineup and to this clubhouse in terms of character.
Very good points, Chris, and I think that your analysis is very well founded on that point, because whether it's Stanton or whether they sign a J.D. Martinez, as much as the outfield has been excellent, and all around it's one of the best in the game, when you look at the throwing arms and the defensive ability, you've got three center fielders, as Dave Dombrowski said to me before the series began, and being an athletic and dynamic outfield, there is a decent chance to me, Chris, that Jackie Bradley Jr. is traded this winter for pitching. And that, of course, opens up a spot. You could either put Benintendi in center, which I think is probably the most prudent move, because Mookie's just that great in right field. And Benintendi, while it doesn't have a great throwing arm, I think certainly is well good enough to play center field. So you'd put Benintendi in center, Betts in right, and maybe then you sign a Stanton to play trade for a Stanton to play left, or you sign a J.D. Martinez to play left, or if Justin Upton opts out, you sign him to play left. There are enough bats out there that I think that makes sense as a logical move. I also think that Dustin Pedroia is still, in many respects, Chris, the heart and soul of this team, but it's hard to lead when you're not feeling good physically and when you're not producing the way that you know that you can. And Dustin Pedroia is a special guy in the history of the Red Sox, and in the recent times in Major League Baseball, someone who I admire a great deal, and that he's got that smoldering, burning desire to play and to excel. The attitude he's got is great. It's basically, if you're going to help me win a game today, I love you, and if not, I don't have a lot of time for you, which I think
is
very productive. Yes, and I think it's perfect. But I think that over time, Chris, when you enter a different phase of your career where your body just simply doesn't allow you to be on the field as often, I think that Dustin, as great as that mentality has been for him, I think it could also bring some frustration at this time of his career. So I'm sure there's going to be some introspection for him this winter time about how he can help in sort of the later years of his career, because candidly, that's where he is headed, if he's not there already. He's such an important part of the Red Sox, but I really believe on so many levels, Chris, that the Dustin Pedroia has to be part of the solution here, because he can dictate in a way that I don't believe really anybody else can in that clubhouse the temperature of that room. I also think that on a positive side, David Price enters spring training in a much different frame of mind than you would have thought a month ago. He was, on many levels, one of the saviors of this team, at least in a very narrow form, in this series. I realize that they didn't win the series, but David Price was the hero of the team on some level. So that has to change David's perspective. I had a chance to talk to him during the series. He seemed great. So I think that, at the very least, changes maybe the tenor of the conversation around David Price entering 2018.
Yeah, I think David Price was really the big winner for the Red Sox, even though they lost overall in that playoff series. And he was their best pitcher, I think, in the series. I do want to walk back to something you said there, though, John Paul, that was interesting. You think Jackie Bradley Jr., who has hit 192 with one extra base hit and 13 strikeouts and 25 at-bats over the last two postseasons, could be on the trading block for more pitching. Do you have any specific players that you've heard connected to the Red Sox in which they would deal Jackie Bradley Jr.?
No, it's a little too early for that, I think, right now, Chris. But I will say this. Teams that need an outfield bat, I would say pay close attention to San Francisco, because they need either a center fielder or a corner bat, and Jackie can play both. And they do have some young pitching there in San Francisco, where that's one team and one situation to watch closely. The Giants, they like Giancarlo Stanton. They would like an Upton or a J.D. Martinez as well. So I think that's one team to watch very carefully, because they need a bat in the worst way. They had the fewest home runs of any team in baseball. And Jackie has home run potential. While, as you mentioned, the postseason has been a bit of a struggle, that would not surprise me if that becomes a fit as we enter the offseason, Jackie Bradley and the San Francisco Giants.
Very interesting. I wanted to ask you this, because coming into this year, there was so much talk about the Red Sox and their young core, which Jackie Bradley Jr. is part of, along with Mookie Betts, Andrew Benintendi, Xander Bogaerts, that this was going to set them up for preeminence in the American League East for years to come, and the Yankees were a little ways away. Well, here we are on October 11th, the Yankees are still playing, and the Red Sox are done. In baseball, people looking at it moving forward, would you rather be the Yankees right now or the Red Sox?
Great question, Chris. I would answer the Yankees, because they've got a phenomenal amount of young talent, and even they've got what I would describe as young veterans, guys that are still under control for at least another year or so, and potentially more. That have a fair amount of experience. Sonny Gray is one such player, although he hasn't had a great playoff to date. Luis Severino has got a lot of experience and really redeemed himself with a very strong start in Game 4 for the Yankees against the Indians. Tanaka, we'll see what happens with him in terms of opting out or not. Their bullpen is so deep, Chris. I just think on so many levels, I like the way things look with them. Didi Gregorius has been a phenomenal talent for them. So I just like the energy they're playing with. And, of course, all that being said, there's now newfound scrutiny on Joe Girardi as their manager. Will he come back next year, depending on how things go in Game 5, or even if they win Game 5? So there's a lot in play there for the Yankees, and that's why I've thought for a long time that Girardi would want to return, because it's such a fun, young roster, and he's talking about how much he's really been reinvigorated by the youth there. I think that's a team, Chris, that I look at as being very strong for years to come. And I think one global point about this in the American League in general is we just saw the Astros play, and that Astros team, they now have Justin Verlander for 2 more years. They still have Dallas Keuchel. Lance McCullers Jr. is hopefully for them going to get healthier for time to come. There's just a lot to like about these teams in the American League right now, where it is getting more competitive, Chris, than ever before to win the American League.
And John Paul, we'll get you out on this. Just quickly, give me your World Series prediction.
Well, when the postseason began, I said Indians over Cubs. And since they're both still involved, I've got to stay with that. Even though my predictions are usually pretty bad, I guess
predictions
I'll stay
with
that.
Occupational hazard, JP.
Yes, they very much are, Chris. But I will say for now, since I'm already on record as picking that with MLB.com, I will hang with that as my pick there, Indians over the Cubs.
Thanks, John Paul. That's John Paul Morosi of MLB Network and Fox Sports. Join us here on Season Ticket, and John Paul will be covering the National League Championship Series, so you'll be seeing more of him on television. We thank him for joining us today. Thanks, John Paul.
Chris, my pleasure. Just continuing the conversation there from Morrissey Boulevard about 15 years ago, my friend. It was a lot of fun.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up in just a minute, the Celtics have a lot of new pieces. They have to decide where they fit into the puzzle. We have the perfect person to tell us where they fit. That's coming up next on Season Ticket. Welcome back to Season Ticket. A quick note for you guys. If you like Season Ticket, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to assure you'll get our show as soon as it's available. All right, as promised, we're moving on to the Celtics now. They play their final preseason game Wednesday night in Charlotte against the Hornets. That's the last dress rehearsal before they start the season, October 17th in Cleveland against the Cavaliers and LeBron James. Now, look, they've only played three preseason games. They have 11 new players. There's a lot of ground to cover for coach Brad Stevens, and there's a lot of ground to cover with Boston Globe Celtics beat writer Adam Himmelsbach. Adam, what's up? How you doing?
Great, Chris. How's everything going?
Going really well. So the biggest thing with this team, obviously, is Kyrie Irving's here, Gordon Hayward's here. They have these premium players, but these guys have not played a game that really matters in a Celtic uniform. You have the team last year that was a number one seed in the Eastern Conference, won 53 games, and basically got blown up. How are these guys gelling so far?
Yeah, I think that's the big question, because when you look at the last year's team and, you know, the season before that, which is pretty much the same team, a lot of people thought they overachieved. And part of that was because they got along well together and they had like this unusual cohesion on the court and off the court. And it just worked. And I think people are wondering with this team, is this going to work? Can these guys come together in a pretty short time? Look, it was like a shortened preseason, short training camp, and there's all these new pieces that Brad Stevens has to kind of mold into with Clay. And how are they going to put this all together in time? The question, but the other part of it is, like, it's an 82-game season, as you know, Chris. It slogs on. If they don't have it all figured out right now, if they don't figure it out in 2 months, they'll be okay, as long as it's figured out December, January, and they start to find a rhythm.
Yeah, it probably will be a work in progress. It's funny, though, because the precedent here on the parquet for this sets a very high standard. It's the new big three. It's having Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen team up, and from the jump, they were great. That team won 66 games, so I think people around here are sort of expecting that, and that might not be the case with Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward and Jason Tatum, the number three pick in the draft, and just trying to find where all these guys fit into the team, and everyone's going to have to find a role. Do you get the sense, at least so far, that in terms of leadership, guys are sort of walking on eggshells? No one wants to offend anybody at this point by sort of taking the team by the horns?
Yeah, it's tough to say, because that stuff comes out when, you know, there's adversity. And right now, it's every training camp around the league, everyone's hopeful and optimistic. Of course, the Celtics have better reason than most to feel that way. But it'll be interesting to see when the season starts and, when, you know, if they go down to Cleveland on Tuesday night and get stomped, what's the response? Who kind of steps up and says, all right, here's what we're doing wrong. Here's how we're going to handle this. The one thing they do have, this one constant, and it's a pretty good constant to have, is Brad Stevens, a guy that's so even keel and has shown such a real ability to kind of bring guys together and formulate a plan and get them playing, like seeing his vision. And I think having him here will help a lot in this transition without question than most other coaches that you could have in this situation.
No, I got the sense that Brad was a little hesitant about all the change. I think he really liked the team he had before. It was a team of guys who played really hard with the Jay Crowders and the Avery Bradleys and the Isaiah Thomases, guys that had something to prove and were really self-motivated. Now he has some guys. Certainly he coached Gordon Hayward at Butler, so he knows him. But Gordon's
Brad coached
grown
Gordon
a little
Hayward,
bit.
Chris? I didn't know. We've not heard that one yet.
yeah, stop me if you've heard this before. Brad Stevens and Gordon Hayward have history in college basketball. So obviously he knows Gordon, but you know, Kyrie Irving's established as a star in this league and already has a championship ring. Marcus Morris is a strong personality that you've brought in here. How has Brad sort of responded to this team so far and made that adjustment with a lot of guys that, you know, he doesn't really know that well and maybe doesn't know how to reach yet?
Yeah, it's hard to say at this point because, of course, they haven't played a game and they've played three preseason games. But, I mean, he's excited. I think, of course, like you said, he liked that group. He loved that group. They were gritty. You know, they were a bunch of guys with chips on their shoulders. This team is different. This team might have to create those chips in some way, but right now it doesn't have them. But Brad also realizes, look, Kyrie Irving's one of the best players in the world. Gordon Hayward's one of the best, maybe 20 or so players in the world. Like, when you put these players in front of me, I'm pretty excited about what I might be able to do with them and what we might be able to do as a group.
I think there's pressure on everybody this year, Adam, with the Celtics. It's a little different this year. You mentioned it. Sort of the expectations for the team. They're expected to be not only good, but really great, to be one of the four best teams in the NBA this season. But I think the person who has the most to gain or lose this season is Kyrie Irving. He asked out of Cleveland, where he was with LeBron James and had gone to three straight finals, because he wanted his own team. I think ultimately the success or failure of the 2017-2018 Celtics is going to be attached to him, whether that's fair or not.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I mean, even Monday night's preseason game, Kyrie, Hayward, and Horford didn't play. It's the fourth quarter. It's a blowout. The game's over. And the fans spent, like, most of the fourth quarter just chanting Kyrie's name, the fans who were still there. And I'm not sure if that was because there were people who just went to a preseason game or were hoping Brad Stevens might throw him in, which of course was not going to happen, or if it was like they're welcoming him, like, hey, Kyrie Irving, like, this is your team now, like, we need you. And they weren't chanting. I kind of felt bad for Gordon Hayward. Like, here's a guy who signed here as an all-star. Nobody was chanting Gordon Hayward's name. There's no doubt this is Kyrie Irving's team. This is what he wanted. This is what he asked for. And really, quite frankly, he's pretty fortunate that the team he happened to land on is the Celtics. Like, he could have been traded anywhere. He could have been traded to the Suns. You know, right now he could be on the Phoenix Suns or something, which he would probably be miserable. He landed for just about the perfect situation he could have asked for, and now the pressure's going to be on him to do something with it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that in terms of the pressure. What's funny about this Celtics team is that the longest tenured player now is Marcus Smart, who was the sixth pick in the 2014 draft. That just sounds really strange. And it's one crazy. Question is, how much longer will Marcus Smart be with the Celtics? He's eligible to be a restricted free agent after the season if he and the Celtics do not reach a contract extension before the deadline, which I believe is October 16th. What have you heard in terms of the Celtics and Marcus Smart reaching one of these extensions, a la Gary Harris, a guard for the Denver Nuggets? I'm not saying the money, but just the idea that they reach an extension to keep the player away from restricted free agency, from reaching the market.
Yeah, Marcus was pretty open about this on Monday, which is a little unusual just in general, and especially for him. He doesn't open up about stuff the way a guy like Isaiah Thomas did here in Boston. We asked him about it because a report came out that there haven't been any conversations, and he goes, yep, the Celtics have not reached out to me. They've not reached out to my agent. They haven't said anything, and I'd like to be here. That's not a big surprise, but it'll kind of be hinging on what Danny Ainge wants. And Danny hasn't shown a huge kind of affinity for signing these rookie scale extensions. You know, might be different for a guy like Marcus. Just there's still a week left. It's not like this is something that would probably take 2 weeks of negotiations. They might just be seeing how the market plays out. They might seeing how Marcus continues to kind of perform. And he looks great, by the way. I mean, he legit lost 20 pounds, which sometimes you hear about and it looks like BS, but he legit lost 20 pounds. He's faster. His shot looks better. Of course, it's preseason, but he did everything they asked him to do. And I think his thought is like, all right, I lost weight. I changed my game. Like, here I am. You know, let's figure out this extension. If they don't do it, the thing about restricted free agency some fans might not understand is ultimately he's still in the Celtics' control. If a team signs him to an offer sheet this summer, the Celtics can always match. So wouldn't be like they were giving up their chance to bring back Marcus. They'd more be kind of placing a bet that a team wouldn't throw a massive deal at him this summer.
You mentioned there Isaiah Thomas, and there was a story in Sports Illustrated Lee Jenkins wrote about Isaiah Thomas and just sort of the aftermath of the great season he had last year for the Celtics and then getting traded to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Kyrie Irving deal. Isaiah Thomas saying in that story that he's not sure he'll ever talk to Celtics president of basketball operations, Danny Ainge, the man who dealt him, ever again.
With Danny, yeah. Isaiah's hurt. And he's made the one thing, Chris, you remember with Isaiah's time here, Isaiah will not pull any punches. He will tell you exactly how he's feeling. And that's what we loved about him. He was always honest, sometimes brutally honest. And he was hurt by the fact that Danny Ainge gave up on him, especially considering everything he did for this franchise, from playing hurt, from playing through, you know, the death of his sister, from going and he came back from his vacation in San Diego to go have dinner with Gordon Hayward just to get him here. And then like a few weeks later, he was gone. And that hurt him. And Danny was the one who made that call. And Isaiah's a guy, his whole life, he's been overlooked and tossed aside. He's always tried to find things to drive him. And this is his new thing. It's going to be like, all right, Danny Ainge, you think I can't do this? Well, here's what I'll have to show you. We're not going to see it opening night. We might not see it for a few months, but Isaiah is confident that he will be back.
All right, that's Adam Himmelsbach, Boston Globe Celtics beat reporter, sort of filling us in on where the Celtics stand at this point. That season is right around the corner. Trust me, folks, it's going to creep up on us real quick. It's almost time for them to play the Cavaliers. Finally, a segment we call the Cheap Seats. The U.S. men's soccer team played a crucial game last night. They needed to beat Trinidad and Tobago to advance to the 2018 World Cup in Russia. It did not go well.
Driven across towards the penalty spot, tips up, and in! Winchester, not even sure how he did it. It's a trick shot of sorts, but it loops over Tim Howard and Trinidad and Tobago in front.
That was American defender Omar Gonzalez scoring a dreaded own goal to give Trinidad and Tobago a 1-0 lead. They would go on to win the match 2-1. Here's the problem for U.S. soccer. If you're going to make your pitch to the American sporting public, you have to actually be on the pitch at the World Cup, and they're not going to be. The U.S. men's soccer team red, white, and blew it against Trinidad and Tobago. missing the World Cup for the first time since 1986 because they lost 2-1 on the road on Tuesday. This should serve as a wake-up call to the U.S. soccer establishment because, honestly, for too long, U.S. soccer has just been kicking the ball around. They've been behind, and they have not advanced technically or tactically. Hopefully, what comes out of this disaster is a better U.S. soccer program. That's it for this edition of Season Ticket. If you liked us, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. For more great stories, subscribe to the Boston Globe. Season Ticket is a production of WBUR iLab and the Boston Globe. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll see you tomorrow.